07.
You are listening to Two Magicians, One Mic.
Welcome to Two Magicians, One Mic, post-Macau session.
This is the epilogue.
This is the epilogue. This is your idea. I was like, I don't know what the point of this is.
You were done with this goddamn podcast.
You know what? I had somebody come up to me. I think I was telling you this a couple days ago. I was at the Castle all week performing, and somebody came up and said, hey, I've listened to every episode. I really enjoyed the podcast. And I thought he was joking for his. Like, I'm like, yeah. Nobody listens to this podcast. But he seemed to have a great time and really enjoyed it, and he was thanking me in some specific things. And that meant a lot. That really did. It's so funny. Mm. You work so hard on shows, but this little side project, it's so nice to know that I hope people get something out of it, and it seemed like he did, you know, and that's all I ever wanted. You know, I don't want any sort of income or financial success from this podcast, but artistically, I hope it helps people. Mm. You know, it's just verbal therapy, as I've said many times.
Anyone who doesn't work in the creative / entertainment industry or has never done a podcast doesn't realize that people only see those runaway success stories of someone does a thing and it reaches millions of people. And people don't hear about the 99% of stories where people just throw a thing out into the void and it gets barely any attention. Mm-hmm. That's the default expectation for any creative thing you ever work on, is that it will get almost no attention.
Yeah.
And after you do this kind of stuff for a while, you know, the people in the business know that those runaway success things are anomalies. Yeah. That's not what's likely to happen. It can happen. And you put it out there hoping, again, it will connect with at least somebody.
Yeah, that's the whole. That should be the organic goal. You shouldn't, but it's hard because we make our living off of this. So, I've been thinking a lot about how my show can be commercially successful and how it cannot be, and how it's sometimes a good thing that your show doesn't work. Like, I had a very drunk crowd one of the nights this week at the Castle, and if it would have worked, I don't know how I would have thought about that, because they were just literally making verbal drunk commentary about the whole thing the whole time. And it's like, even though I was very pissed off about it and angry at them, well, same thing. But I had to take a step back and go, oh, that's okay, because this isn't for them. Yeah. This isn't for them to get.
Yeah.
But we're back in America.
We are back in America.
You did a ship. Two ships.
I did two ships.
You literally left China, came back to LA, and then went back to China.
I know. It was amazing. I got back and flew to Shanghai to get in a ship that went from Shanghai to Kobe. Mm-hmm. Kobe, however you pronounce it.
And then you hopped on another ship, yeah?
I got back, got on a ship that went... God, where did it even go? That's right. It was Tahiti to San Diego.
Naturally.
And so it was this 7 days ocean crossing, 7 days at sea, which was really sublime to ridiculous. Such an amazing contrast from being in Macau, then getting back I literally got back for one night, went up to Monterey for 2 days of a 3-day conference, then flew to the ship. Got on the ship, was at sea for 7 days, got back to LA, was back for about 4 days, flew to Shanghai, got on another ship, got off on Japan, flew back to LA. So I've just been jumping left, right through the time zones. And now I'm back for 6 days before I get on another ship in 2 days.
Oh, my God. That's just cruise ship crazy.
Yeah, and you know what? It's the best thing. It's exhausting, but oh, my God, it's I'm so happy about this.
Because... it seems, at least when I've done ships, the bulk of the work is just the travel.
Yeah,
because
completely.
Because compared to what we're doing in Macau, which is, you know, 3 to 7 or 8 shows a day, you're doing a couple shows a week, if that.
Yeah, the contrast is astonishing.
So you get to spend more time and focus on the individual show as opposed to just boom, 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 just constantly thinking about the next one.
And you know what? It's funny now, having gone from such an extreme contrast so rapidly, from infinity shows a week down to 2 shows a week. Mm-hmm. But somewhere in there's a happy medium, because 2 is too few. There becomes so much pressure on each individual
show.
Whereas that was one of those great things about Macau, as we talked about, that each individual show, meh, something goes wrong, meh. We got another 3 coming up later in the day.
Yeah.
It was fine, so it was less stressful.
We were talking about this the other day of, I've always been a firm believer in the 10,000-hour rule and the Malcolm Gladwell thing, but I think we may have disproved it a little bit doing that, because at least for me personally, I kind of reached a limit of being able to get better.
Mm.
It became the point of my body just got tired.
Yeah.
And I even though I was mentally pushing myself or trying to, my body physically wouldn't react sometimes. And that was interesting.
And that 10,000 hour thing has actually been extensively debunked and disproven. That it's a great rule of thumb at a very rough, vague level, but it only applies to some things and not other things. It depends on what kinds of hours. And everyone seems obsessed with it, but it's not a very useful rule.
Mm-hmm.
It's only useful in terms of, hey, work really hard for a long time on things, and that's a good idea. But beyond that, it's a very arbitrary number that has minimal relevance to reality. But yeah, that's the thing, because you do kind of get better, and then you can get worse with doing something too much.
Yeah.
Or getting too complacent with it, or getting too used to it, or forgetting. Sometimes what makes you good is the fact that it's new and exciting, and so your brain is engaging differently with it. And once that goes, then it can get worse. I've noticed that tricks I've done for years, and I look back at old videos and realize they look better in the old videos. And then I have to try and work out what it is that's changed about my handling that's making it not as good.
Yeah, what did you do different? I think for me specifically, I've been analyzing the egg trick I do. And when I first started doing it, it was okay. And then I got to a point where I was like consistently really getting laughs with it. And then I think Macau just beat it out of me. And this whole week, I've been getting laughs with it. But it's not like, it's funny. Like my sleight of hand has gotten way better with it. But the joke part of it has actually gotten worse, I think. Because I'm like, I'm getting less laugh. And I just like you, I can prove it. I'll go back and watch a video from 6 months ago. I'm like, this is doing a lot better than it is now. And you kind of notice those subtle variations that you start doing, like whether you're pushing too hard or too little. And it's not from an apathetic stance, but it's from an overdone stance, I think. But what are your thoughts about being back in the U.S. of A.?
Oh, it's amazing. It's so great.
You're talking to your lawyer today, too, about hopefully your immigration status is good.
I sat down and ran the numbers on the calendar and realized I'm currently, because again, I'm in the gloriously privileged position to have a bunch of cruise things booked throughout the year. And I'm going back to Melbourne in July for the Melbourne Magic Festival for 2 weeks, which will be great. And I looked at the calendar and I realized I'm due to spend very slightly, about 2 days over the half-day mark out of the U.S. this year. I think 186 days I'm going to be gone from America. And there are certain, when you're on a green card, a U.S. permanent resident visa, there are certain constraints and restrictions about time spent outside the U.S. Because if you're a permanent resident, you're meant to be permanently residing. You're meant to be here. But luckily, I confirmed with my lawyer, because I got a couple of other cruise offers, which, again, great. But I was worried if I took them, it would put me too far over that threshold. But it only, spending too much time out of the U.S. only applies over a 5-year period leading up to going for citizenship. So if you apply for citizenship, they look at the previous 5 years from that point, and if you've spent more than 50% of that 5 years outside the U.S., then it can be a bit of a problem. But year by year, it's totally fine. So as long as I just think about that going forward. The other exception is if you leave the U.S. for more than half the year on one single trip, then that's a big problem. But luckily, this is all lots of short trips that are just adding up collectively to a lot of time. So I'm fine. Confirmed fine. Immigration's okay.
You're not kicked out yet.
Big weight. But it's so good to be back.
Yeah.
Just critical thinking. Amazon Prime. Recognizable food.
This is a great advertisement for Amazon Prime.
My two favorite things about the America are, one, Amazon Prime. Two, diner booth-style seating.
Wow, I never thought about that. Yeah, not much booth seating.
No booth seating. You notice that? Whole China, no booths.
I can't believe I never noticed that till now.
Yeah, it was something.
Because in Europe, you kind of get, like in like Paris and London, you kind of get used to like squished tables.
Yeah, little intimate tables.
Tiny, because people don't spend, they go eat and they'll, I don't know, you're there, then you're not there too long. So that makes sense. But it's weird. Just little, all those subtle differences. I think I was saying this to you. We got back to the airport and we flew into Chicago, so we're suddenly in the Midwest, and you just see all these cultural Midwestern things of people yapping really loud, telling you unnecessary details about something that from their day to like somebody working the cashier at Starbucks, and you're like, why does that matter? But you didn't care. You're like, yes, share your thoughts.
Tell me things.
Have a personality.
Have a point of view and a personality. It's also amazing just being able to freely speak English when performing. thinking about routines and what it's like to do magic. And don't get me wrong, I was loving performing in Mandarin. I actually do miss that. I really enjoyed getting to perform in Mandarin. But it is just nice to be able to really craft a more subtle, engaging presentation than what was possible over there.
Sure.
And it's funny, also being back has made me realize just how good it was to do that many shows, just to have experienced that. Because you can't imagine it until you do it. You can't imagine that feeling of, you know, that confidence you get after having done it so much, just going, I might be exhausted and have mild food poisoning, and I have 200 people whose world I have to rock. Yeah, we got this. It's fine. I can do that. No problem. And not of a complacency thing, but just a complete comfortable knowledge that you know you've got this because you've done this so many times. You can do it in your sleep now. And that means observing them, connecting them with them, being present with them and doing a great show. But that becomes just so easy after you've had that much experience with it.
It does. And it was a little jarring going back to American audiences for me.
Yeah.
More so than I thought it would be.
Well, it's funny because you've done way more shows in America since than me because you just did a Castle Week, which means you're at least 20 shows above my count so far.
Yeah, and I came back and I immediately did like a family cabaret show that I do over in Anaheim, and then I went and did Disneyland and, you know, performing for families again, and then you go back to the Castle, which is all adults, and just those variations. You see the variations of American audiences as opposed to, you know, Chinese audiences, but they're much more subtle compared to Chinese. Chinese audiences were all over the place. They were either super quiet, super receptive.
The huge variability.
So just
the occasional old woman just walking through the stage area, oblivious.
My favorite one that always comes to mind is some business dude, Chinese, in the back. His phone starts ringing. He picks it up. He has the thought process to go further into the theater where people aren't sitting. But he still picks up the phone. And I pointed at – I wasn't even mad. I just kind of pointed at him and make a gesture of a phone with my hand and go, what? And he goes, oh, and he pulls it down. And I'm like, okay, he got it. And then literally 2 minutes later, he gets up and is on the phone, walks in front of the stage staring at me as if I'm the weirdo. And I just this is the point where I'm blowing up the giant balloon. So all the focus is on me. So there's no way the audience doesn't pull focus and look at him.
That's not a euphemism. That's a literal thing Nick does in his act. Well, thinking about people who haven't seen your show.
It's true.
And wouldn't know. It's amazing. You get to that point where you're not even angry. It's just, you're just astonished.
You're just like, what
is China going to throw at you next? What bizarre thing will happen?
I think it was like the last week of just getting to that state of, all right, here we go. That's fine.
It's been great, though. I've noticed my performances are better here now because of that Macau experience, massively. Just because of how I was actually on the Magic Club podcast yesterday.
What's the Magic Club?
It's Jordan Gold and Andrew Main are doing a video cast.
This is all getting edited out. We're not promoting other podcasts. Unless they promote mine.
I mentioned this on theirs.
Oh, okay. I'll
mentioned
leave it
the
in
Macau
then.
Sessions on theirs.
I'll leave it in.
It's all relevant. And we were talking about that fact that when you do that much stuff, one of the biggest things I got out of it was that it forced me to be even more present in the audience's minds, as in really focusing on their experience of the show rather than my experience of the show. Because my experience of the show is pretty similar every time. I'm doing the same lines and the same moves and the same jokes and everything. But their experience of it is going to be so different the first time they've ever heard that line or the first time they've ever seen that moment. And it, through almost as a self-preservation mechanism, not to go insane from boredom and repetition, it forced me to really put my head into my attention on what was happening in their heads. And you want to do that anyway, but it's hard to really learn to do that. So now getting back to the US, and I'm noticing now I'm even more present in the audience's experiences than I was before, really focusing on what is this individual unique audience experiencing from this stuff that I'm doing, rather than focusing on what am I doing, what am I saying, what's happening with me, going, what's happening with them. And it makes you more responsive, more reactive, more improvisational in a good way, more, you adjust your pace to their pace and things like that, really being there with them. And it's great. It's really good.
Yeah, I understand. I've been working on that too, improvising more
within, it's tough to improvise within my set of circumstances, yeah. but I've been discovering, especially coming back to the US, I've been discovering just because people react to things,
yeah.
I'm like, oh, I can react to that too, even if it's nonverbal.
Yeah, you can react to their reaction mm-hmm. and everything else.
And that keeps it fresh for completely. Me and it keeps it fresh for them because the audience is aware that this, okay, this is only happening now.
Yeah.
This is not part of the show.
Yeah, reacting to their reaction, I think, is a good way of putting it at a, definitely at least at a base level, because then you're really, you're focusing on them, you're watching them, you're thinking about them, mm-hmm. you're really being aware of them.
Going back to what you just said, I think that that's also one of the perks of doing China was, once again, you got so used to people, they reacted, but they reacted different ways, they're quieter reactions, mm-hmm. or they're more internal reactions. So when anytime somebody did give you something, you were able to run with it. And so now when tons of reactions are being thrown at me.
Yeah, it's
like, oh, okay.
Amazing. All this is easy. You can really have this build this dynamic with the audience. And every audience is different. And so each show becomes unique
mm-hmm.
in its own way. And then after the show, you can go and get a kale and quinoa salad with grilled salmon that doesn't give you food poisoning. It's great.
Wait, where was this?
Or just at Mel's Diner. Okay. Just about in America. We're in America again.
That's true. You live right next to Mel's Diner. You can go do that.
It's my local. It's also the standard Postcastle late night eatery.
Oh, yeah. I've never eaten there.
Really?
Yeah.
My God.
So we'll have to go. Oh, it's like definitely. This classic Hollywood touristy slash
yeah.
local place. And we've been here almost 2 years, haven't gone.
Yeah, it's the default Postcastle late night food spot because it's the nearest thing to the castle that's open until 3 or 4 in the morning
mm-hmm.
when the castle...
I discovered, like, one of the great perks of working at the castle is you get a card with money on it so you can eat all the fancy magic castle food. But I learned doing the late parlor show, I'm not someone who likes to really eat before a show.
Yeah.
My stomach gets a little bit tight, so I'll have a snack or I'll have something small. But by the time I'm done with my shows, their kitchen is closed. So you just have all this money at the end of the week that you won't be able to use.
Yeah, that's my massive castle pro tip is, I mean, everyone's different, but working the early shifts is way better.
Because mm-hmm.
then you're done and you can enjoy the evening and eat the food and drink and hang out.
I was talking about this with David Gubay, too. He was doing the later close-up as
you
well.
You were the late guys.
Yeah, and
it's brutal.
And you just have the whole day to kill. Like, I spent the whole day with my family at Disneyland on Friday, and that was a mistake because I'm heading over to the castle like 8, and I'm like, why am I so tired? Oh, I look at my Apple Watch. I'm like, oh, I walked over like 9 miles today. Yeah. And now I got to go do 3 shows, which you forget about pacing yourself. And if anybody ever, if you're a performer and ever anybody ever gives you kind of crap about only working for 30 minutes or working for 45 minutes, wear your Apple Watch during a show and see how much your heart rate's been been beating, how many calories you burned. I looked at my Apple Watch after I did 4 30-minute sets at Disneyland last weekend, and it said I walked a whole bunch of extra miles, and basically my workout, I had tripled my workout goal for that day just by doing shows.
Wow.
So it gives me comfort to know. It's like, okay, I'm not working for long periods of time, but you're throwing a crap ton of energy out in one spot.
Yeah, I mean, until I quit 7 years ago now, damn, it's been that long, I worked as a business analyst for a massive international business consulting firm. It's on the Fortune 312 on the Fortune 500, I think. It's a massive company, and I did those 12, 14-hour business consultant, hardcore banker-type days. And yeah, they were exhausting. Comparably exhausting to doing a show in a theater. That's I know what both are like. You know, I've worked long shifts in retail. I've worked in dishwashing and food preparation and catering companies back in university. Performing isn't, it's better, more happy about it, but it is not much easier.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Sometimes much harder.
It's harder sometimes harder. Yeah. I mean, in your... You're exerting probably the same amount of energy, just at different levels of time.
Yeah,
you know?
At different points. I mean, the preparation for the show, the development of the show, the pre-show checklists, the just getting everything organized, just spending that whole day mentally invested in the preparation for it, thinking about all the different outcomes, the setup for it. Depending on the show, I mean, unless it's something like the Castle or Disneyland where it's a bunch of sets in the same place. If it's a private or corporate, you've got to work out traveling to the show, getting there, organizing, loading in, bumping in. For the cruise ships, again, like you said, a lot of the work is the air travel.
Yeah.
Just actually getting to the gig. And
it's, your stuff
and this
arrives.
Isn't luxury, happy, fun air travel. This is zigzag of destinations all over the place.
We're going to connect you 3 different times to get to
Did I tell you my one? This was the second cruise I ever did. The ship was docked in quote-unquote Beijing, but what that means is actually Tianjin, which is a city maybe 2.5 hours drive away.
Oh, this is a good story. Yeah,
which is the port town. So Beijing, I believe, doesn't have an actual port, but Tianjin is the big port town. So the ship will dock in Tianjin, and then for the passengers slash guests, they'll have a day trip to Beijing and check it out. And so I was landing in Beijing to get on the ship in Tianjin, and for whatever reason, to this day, I never bothered to find out. Someone screwed up, and the pickup to get me from the airport to the ship wasn't there. So I had to somehow get from Beijing to Tianjin. I had about 5 hours to do it, which was not long at that point. And long story short, thank God I spoke Mandarin, because otherwise I do not know how I would have managed it, because I had to, all the sort of car services and buses and things, they weren't available. There was nowhere to find them. Luckily, I got my agent on Wi-Fi, which I had to hack because China doesn't give Wi-Fi to you unless you have a Chinese mobile number. Luckily, I managed to do a weird thing where iMessages were getting through, but nothing else was getting through. And he was helping. He found me a couple of car services, but they weren't responding or were booked out or weren't available at short notice. In the end, I had to negotiate with a cab driver, just a random cab, and go, hi. It would be like being in LA and trying to get a cab to take you to San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I need to, and this is all in my semi-broken Mandarin. Hi, I need to get to Tianjin. Yes, I know how far that is. What's it going to cost? And then go and withdraw a wad of cash, because it's renminbi, it's Chinese yuan. And he drove me to Tianjin. But the problem is, I'm aware in that cab, I am completely at this man's mercy now. And I started to really think about my kidneys and how much I valued them, because I don't know if this if he takes me the wrong place, or I've got the wrong details and the ship isn't there.
Sure, there's a lot of ice packs in here.
A lot of things, and it got darker because the sun was setting at this point. And we're driving just down endless freeways.
Just
and
in China.
And yeah, in China, and it occurred to me, if this goes wrong, I'm just now stuck 2.5 hours out from Beijing with all my bags and no idea where to go. And the final 20-minute drive was this long, completely straight highway down to the Tianjin port. Everything was dark except for the streetlights. No other cars. I wondered if I'd ended up in the afterlife. And this was actually crossing the River Styx or something like that, down this endless, endless freeway. And then finally, we turn the corner and the ship comes into view. And I've never been happier to actually see a ship. Turns out I'd actually missed the all-aboard time. And they'd written me off as having not turned up. Luckily, they then went, oh, wait, you're here? All right, hang on. The ship's departure got delayed because they had to then bring the immigration officials back to process me because they'd already gone. And it was insane.
If anybody thinks performing on cruise ships is easy, it's not. Because yeah. I've had an experience. Like, I've only done, 6 or 7 cruise ships, you know. I'm still relatively new to it, but in that 6 or 7, I've had experiences like that. Not as bad, but...
That's what I love. I've told anyone who's worked ships, hears that story and goes, oh, yeah, that's worse than average. It's not that, oh, my God, that's horrible. That's definitely worse than average, but not that surprising.
So when people are like, oh, you only got to do 2 shows this week? It's like, no, I had to go through hell to get to do these 2 shows.
You also have to be very polite to all the people on board. Exactly. You are 24/7 brand ambassador when you're on that ship.
Mm-hmm.
You are, yes, it's great. Again, it was one of the best gigs I've ever had. I'm very happy about it, but you are... not just fully relaxing.
It's weird not being like
on the best behavior.
I don't know how yours was set up, but literally going down, doing the show, leaving, going down 2 flights of stairs and going to my room. You know, you're living in the theater, you know, and the boat is the theater.
It's the other point is that every person on board, at least every paying person on board, can and usually does write a review on you, whether it's just rating you out of 10 or writing a comment about you. So you have to and they might love your show but think you're a douchebag and you'll get a bad review and you won't get booked again.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to be really... full customer service role.
Yeah, I mean, I had some, long story short, very first cruise with an agent. I thought it went fine. The director said they were kind of underimpressed. And I had to convince my agent. I was like, no, this happened. Everything seemed fine. And then a great book ending was in December, same exact cruise director, entertainment director, a lady. You know, as I'm leaving to say goodbye, she says, I just got off the phone with somebody who was just screaming at me, yelling, and said that the only good thing on the ship was the magician. So thanks. I'm like, can you call my agent right
Please
now?
Please tell them that. So. And I remember you telling me that story, and I hugely appreciated that because it gave me useful info about what to watch out for. Mm-hmm. And it was very good to know going in about.
So now after every show, I mean, I still try to do it. You know, we referred to it in Macau as making the people happy, but
yeah.
I do like to go out and say goodbye to people, and you know, it's kind of required on a cruise ship though, because like you said, those people are. If whether they realize it or not, are in charge of whether or not you get hired again.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, hope you like. And that goes back to what we were talking about earlier of, okay, how commercial is my show? How much do I want it to be a niche thing? How much do I want it to appeal to everybody? And a cruise ship is tough because you're getting all walks of life.
This was fascinating. I remember, speaking of getting back to America, which is ostensibly the theme of this epilogue, I got back, and I think my second night back in the U.S. after Macau, actually no, it was after Macau and after the ship, because there was, I think, literally one day between them. I went to Scott Neri's Booby Trap, which is a great weekly LA variety show.
I have to cancel tomorrow. But sorry, Scott.
We'll plug you as recompense for.
If you're in LA, go see. It's the weirdest, craziest variety show.
Amazing. You will see
awesome.
Every night. You will see a whole bunch of bizarre, miscellaneous stuff. You will definitely see a couple of fantastic things. You will definitely see a couple of awful things. And you will be entertained. It's
every
great.
Wednesday night in L.A. Check it out. It's Scott Neri's Booby Trap.
And it began as an open mic, a place where everyone got 4 minutes. Now it's booked and actually curated, but everyone still gets exactly 4 minutes. And then you get gonged off if you go a second over time. But what was interesting was I went to this night, and I'd just done 3 months in Macau and then this week on a cruise ship. And whenever you watch anything, you have different lenses you can view it through. You can look at it as a, you know, all the different things based on your experience. You see things through different lenses. And I realized I now had this lens of Macau veteran, and I'm still very new to cruises, but I'd done enough of them to have a sense of what they're about. And I was watching it, and watching, because LA is a very intelligent city. It's very intelligent. It's very, what's the word, culture. It's very, seen a lot of film, a lot of TV, a lot of theater, a lot, listened to a lot of music. It's right at the, it's ahead of the global culture consumption market. People have seen stuff. And consequently, it ends up rewarding meta culture and sarcasm and irony and people being clever and being sort of sarcastically clever
about
things.
That wasn't good, but it was clever.
Yeah, exactly. or even if it's good and clever. And you notice how, and this happens in every industry, people play to their peers. So the comedians are trying to out-clever the other comedians. So the other comedians go, oh, that's clever. And I was watching it, enjoying it, but thinking a lot of this stuff that's doing well in this room would never get booked for a ship or a casino-like venue.
Yeah.
Because it's not accessible enough for the average crowd. It's great for the in-group, the industry, the comedians and the magicians and the other people who know this stuff and know what the references are to and everything. And then it got me thinking about the overlap between the Venn diagram sets of what would play well at something like Booby Trap that would also play well on, say, a cruise ship or in a casino.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an overlap. It's a very narrow overlap. And the thing I realized is what plays well for both is just really good demonstration of skill and ability. Whether it's comedic or musical or magical or whatever, just someone doing something that's really damn impressive. And because then people go, wow, I've seen things like a completely played straight juggling or aerial act kick ass at Booby Trap. People go, wow, that's amazing and impressive and beautiful and whatever. And that'll also play well for any audience.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, that takes a lot of effort. Whereas if you're smart, writing a joke takes a lot of effort, but a lot less effort than spending years crafting a skill that's then visibly skillful.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I have no real conclusions on that, but it was just funny really seeing the contrast of what plays well in the environments we spent in China, in a casino, in a very family, publicly accessible, focused entertainment venue, or on a ship, and then in the trenches of LA show business.
Yeah, I think it's important to make sure. We were talking about this kind of one of the earlier episodes of this Macau Sessions of making sure your show, I think it's important that your show should be able to play for many different types of audiences.
Well, if you want to ever make money from it,
I mean, if you don't care about that, great.
Yeah, good for
or
you.
If you're doing something else, I mean, it's weird. I'm coming to a point where I am envious of people who only perform when they want to and have a writing job or whatever. In this town, you can have many multiple cool jobs, but in other parts of the states, it's like, okay, you I don't know, you have a desk job and then you perform occasionally.
Lawyer, yeah. And then occasionally do shows when you want to.
Which to me is very different than somebody who writes on a sitcom and is also a performer.
Yeah.
Because that's still a creative field.
There's a lot more overlap between those professions than there are.
Yeah. So, I mean, without judging it, but just it's been a little bit of a revelation for me of, oh, that's really cool where you can perform when you want and you're only performing for things you're passionate about. Mm. That's kind of cool.
Eugene Berger had a great line about it in one of his books way back that he said there's a big difference between performing because you've got an exciting new thing you're ready to test for an audience and performing because it's 7 p.m. on a Wednesday.
Yeah. Yeah. I just found out it literally, right before we started this, I have to go perform at, 8 p.m. on a Tuesday.
Or performing because it's 2:30 and 3 o'clock and 4:20 and 4:40 and 5:45 and 5:30 and 7:30 and 8:30 on every day.
Yeah, I mean, that was probably the biggest takeaway from Macau is performing at 2 o'clock on a Saturday for people that probably should have bought tickets to the 6 o'clock because it's just going to be a better overall experience for everybody in terms of excitement and energy of the show.
Oh, look, let's hope they get them all packed out and the House of Magic thrives and goes from strength to strength.
I hope so. I just hope Macau thrives because it was, I think I was talking to Arthur Trace who did it for 4 months and he did 390 shows. Wow. I did 233 and 3. Mm. So he was clearly there at a much busier time where they were doing, double shows. So I would be curious to do it again with that experience of, because we talked about the double show days and I did prefer them where we, instead of 3 shows, we did 6 shows, audience was a rotate. We do the show right back to back and you get to such a cool state of mind of
you get in the flow.
You're in a flow. You're not overthinking anything. Mm. But I did become a little bit lazier, but it's in terms of just pushing myself harder, but also I was less stressed. It's weird. I heard Stephen Colbert talked about this. If he was worried about doing double shows on Thursday, so they would have a Friday show to release. Mm. And he was talking to somebody that said the second show you do on Thursday is how you should do every show. You'll be in that state of bliss of, I'm fine.
Cool.
I'm
okay. We got this. No problem.
We'll be good.
Yeah. And that was again, one of the biggest things I got out of Macau is experiencing that for a long time, going, it's fine. We got this. No problem. Doing a show. Whereas now when there's a longer gap between the shows, you worry more, you think more, you overthink more, checking the checklist, if I got everything ready, you're more likely to forget stuff because you're not in that flow state.
It's funny when you're in, it's weird, just like peaks of anxiety for me of shows. That's something I forgot to mention. When I came back, I got absurd, I went to do Booby Trap. That was like one of the first shows I did when I came back. And I was literally shaking before I went on stage. And I'm like, I just did 233 shows, and I'm nervous about this show that I'm not getting paid for?
Yeah, that's 4 minutes.
For these hipsters? All great people, but it's like...
To be fair, that is the Booby Trap target market.
None of these people are going to book me. I'm like, I'm going to get nothing from it. It's purely from an artistic sense to, can I entertain them?
The intrinsic desire to do a good job.
Mm-hmm.
And to make an audience not feel they wasted their time.
And that was an interesting experience. It's like, I took my anxiety medication for the day, and it's not working right now. But it's you power through it, and that was a neat experience.
It's amazing, isn't it? Just and then life goes on, and we deal with new challenges in different ways. There are pros and there are cons of being back and going onwards from here.
Yeah, totally.
It's amazing. I think it is worth mentioning that thing you mentioned earlier about how a lot of people were talking to you, assuming, you've got it made. You're made now. You're good for the year. No problem.
Yeah, everybody I talked to at the castle, it's tough. That's the double-edged sword of social media. Because if you put anything up that looks remotely successful, people just assume you're success. You're fine. But the truth is, my schedule is pretty slow past June. It's pretty wide open, and
that money's great, but it's not going to last forever. Mm-hmm. It's not even going to last till the end of the year by a long shot. Mm-hmm. Got to keep getting booked and getting gigs. And build up savings and invest and do all those things that you want to do as a human being to make your life more stable.
Yeah, I'm at the point now where it's like I could, in LA, it's like impossible to afford
any type of real estate unless you have $1 million or half a million in the bank. But it's that double-edged sword of, I've been doing just kind of, there's a great article on the gig economy in the New Yorker last week. Definitely check it out. A lot of people who like work for Airbnb or TaskRabbit or Uber and stuff, and they talk about just the loneliness factor. And it was a great read. It was a very long article. It was a great read, but it was something I identified with on many different aspects. We're lucky here, we can go to the castle and just chit chat with people.
Built-in community.
Same with House of Magic, we could go and, oh, can you believe this happened? You talk about that. But a lot of the time when you go and do a corporate gig in the middle of nowhere, you're the only one that gets to process that, and then you're done.
That's something I find more and more. And when we had that week off in the middle of Macau, there was really nowhere I wanted to travel alone. I just don't enjoy solo travel very much. It's not fun.
No, it's boring.
So much of any experience is sharing that experience with other people that you can relate to and or care about.
Yeah, I got off the ship when I did a couple ships last year in Hawaii and Alaska, and I just walked around by myself. I'm like, I'm in Hawaii, and I'm bored as shit.
Yeah, but so what? Nice scenery. Yay.
I don't get to share it with anybody. Yeah. I was very lucky that my wife was able to come to China, and it was lucky to have guys like you that were there, and we got to have good friends, but we didn't have many the same off days, so it kind of ruins the whole experience of traveling. Our people think you're on vacation, but really you're not if you don't get to do that.
Our interaction was mostly, so Jax, that was Jax Kitchen.
I never said bye to our friend the maitre d'.
Yeah, I did. We caught up before I left.
I almost did, and then it was almost a cinematic moment where I saw them in there. They didn't see me, because you could walk past and there was like windows, and we would always wave and say hello when I was going to get groceries. But she was looking down, and some of the staff was looking down, and they were just like making a place mad or something for the next table. And I just said, "No, let's just leave it." And I just kept walking.
Wow,
it was
feels so sad, but also oddly appropriate.
It was like no. It was kind of that scene in The Office when Michael Scott leaves of, "Hey, let's not say goodbye. I'll see you later."
Yeah.
It's so heartbreaking. That's how I felt.
Yeah.
It's like, you make these connections with these people for 3 months and you're never, and I think I told you this, like our hair salon, we made good friends with our people at our hair salon and they're like, "Oh, when are you coming back?" Because they knew we were leaving. And I said, "I don't know."
Yeah. We're not sure. It was like that with all, again, for me, the Japanese restaurant in the casino. Yeah, and the Japanese and the Italian restaurant knew them really well. It was really bittersweet. It's sad to say goodbye to a lot of those cool people that you only knew as they were the restaurant staff and
especially
we were the regular
those workers
customer.
Who like would remember your orders. I think we were a highlight for them.
Yeah,
coming in. I don't think they had any clue that we were performers upstage.
Oh no, they did. They definitely did. Okay. They figured it out and word spreads and. I think several of them asked at one point, "You work at House of Magic, right?"
Yeah, and that's cool. But still, I think they find, same with us, we found these weird connections with people that we were so culturally different from and had such vastly different backgrounds.
And also to them, we're surprisingly social and interactive. The same way we found the Chinese audience is very uninteractive. So think about it from their point of view. They're finding us surprisingly conversational. And for a lot of them, the ones at least who we bonded with, we were fascinating to them just because of our cultural background.
And I mean, it goes the same way to them, you know, just trying to listen to their stories and hear their... Because I noticed a few of the workers in one of the restaurants who we'd go to, like halfway through the contract, started to perk up and have personalities.
Yeah.
They were like, "Oh, I can talk to these people. Yeah, it's okay to talk to these people."
They realized that we can be humans rather than just customers they have to be subservient to.
Because there were so many times we would walk in before... that we would kind of see them talking to each other and they would be talking, having a personality, and then we'd show up and they'd immediately go quiet.
Yeah.
And the people that we had known and gotten to know, but yeah, that was pretty fascinating too.
Yeah. Well, it actually reminds you of that story that guy commented about the little girl who brightened up my day, the story that resonated with the listeners last time.
Yeah.
Was realizing that it's entirely possible we were having that kind of effect on lots of those people in the casino. Just by being a engaging, non-douchey customer who treated them as human beings that were interesting. Because that is that culture there. It's very hierarchical. You treat the service staff as service staff. You know, like that guy on his phone in your show, to him, your service staff.
Exactly.
You shouldn't be giving him shit. You should be utterly subservient to him. Mm-hmm. And that's what a lot of those people in those restaurants are dealing with on a day-by-day basis, those kinds of people. And so it's not hard to imagine that they might have really enjoyed us being there.
It's so... It's this. In many ways, it's the same as like a lot of corporate culture here. Of you're a team member. You're part of it. I don't care if you're just, you know, washing dishes. You're part of it. And there, it really, there's a little bit of that, but I don't. They didn't really sugarcoat it that much.
Yeah, not nearly as much.
You're definitely at the bottom of the totem pole. You know it. We know it.
You are service staff. You're here to be subservient and shat on.
And that's how they were treated. You know.
Yeah. Being kind of people who were raised to be polite to everybody and treat everyone as a person with thoughts and feelings. It might be an odd experience.
Yeah. Yeah. So hopefully we've influenced.
Let's hope.
Let's take the egocentric approach and say we changed the future of Macau because we were friendly to people.
Well, maybe in some tiny drop in the ocean way, but it's still a drop.
I don't think so.
It's like everything changing the world.
No, I think they had a much... Just like you said, like that little girl, like I think the effect they had on us was much more profound and certainly changed me, changed my outlook on life and changed. Because you see stuff on TV and you see how other cultures are different and you see how what type of shit people have to deal with. Mm. But when you experience it and see it and it's in a very human form, in a non-documentary form or a non...
Yeah.
Theatrical form where it's just like, oh, I'm observing this moment right now, and no, there's no music, there's no editing, it's just this is happening right now and you can choose how it affects you. That was pretty cool, and I don't know, that was probably the biggest takeaway from existing in another country.
And that's, again, that's a relatively affluent first world one still, let alone what else is out there in the world.
Yeah.
lives of unimaginable privilege that even then are still challenging.
Yeah.
The human condition.
There were days of great depression, just overthinking all that, and other days where you just got up and went to work and didn't let it affect you at all.
Yeah.
Oh, America. Well, do we have any closing thoughts?
It's just good to be back. Glad I did it. Glad I'm back. Yeah, feeling very philosophical at the moment. It's nice. This is the first time since I quit my job to go full magic, a la Tropic Thunder, going full magic, that I felt kind of comfortable in my career right now and life. And it's still not completely comfortable at all, but over the line, above that 50% point of, okay, got a chunk of change in the bank from the gig, did well, was worthwhile, got some things booked. We're doing our fun project for Hollywood Fringe. That's going to be great. I'm looking forward to that. It's not going to make any money, but it'll be fun.
Yeah, if you live in LA, come see the Hollywood Fringe show.
Come see Name This Magic Show with Simon Cronell, Nick Paul, John Armstrong, and John Lovick in no particular order.
Three of the four have been on Penn & Teller Fool Us. I was the one who was
on. Three and counting. Three and counting.
Yeah, definitely check it out. It's good to have that project. And yeah, totally. I yes and what you just said. It's good to have that. It's rare that you can... A, make money, and B, get a cultural experience at the same time.
And now have just a little bit of breathing space, which is a beautiful thing. That's not something I've had for 6.5 years since I quit my job. I've not had a moment to breathe and relax without worrying, where is the next paycheck, where is the next paycheck, where is the next paycheck? So this is a really nice place to be.
Yeah, for sure. So the moral,
check back in 6 months and see if we're still there.
The moral of the story is money does buy happiness.
Oh, well, there was a lot of research about that up to, and this is
like
indexed,
up to 75,000.
Yeah,
like,
well, that index for cost of living in the average USA, which is different from Manhattan, say Iowa, but on average, up to about 70,000 to 80,000, more money absolutely 100% makes you happier, and above that, it actually usually makes you less happy on average.
Every individual's different. I think you begin to expect more.
Yeah, and expectations go up, all the other worries go up. You start to deal with bigger issues that bring you more stress and unhappiness.
Yeah, and you probably purchase things that you really can't afford. Yeah.
And your money ends up owning you.
Yeah,
but yeah, when you have less than that, 100%, your quality of life improves, your stress goes down. Money is important. People.
Yeah, there's that level, and
that was one of those actually really as a, I guess, I don't know if it's a final thought, but this really insidious belief, I was reading a piece on this a while back, that this idea that artists, quote unquote, shouldn't be thinking about money, that somehow thinking commercially is something to look down on in an artist. No, you shouldn't be thinking about money, you should be thinking about the purity of the art. is this complete bullshit idea that only came around in the early mid 20th century. And people like, you know, Monet and Manet and Renoir and all those guys and Da Vinci, they were freaking doing commission pieces. They were 100% thinking about the commercial side of it. Now, I'm not enough of an art historian to know if that's valid, but I could easily believe that.
Sure. But yeah, no, I think we've mentioned that before. That sounds familiar. And yeah, it's just...
I've seen some magicians use calling a trick commercial as almost a veiled insult. Ah, it's commercial. It's like, damn right it is. Got to earn some money so I can relax and then also work on my creative stuff that doesn't have to be commercial because I did some commercial freaking material.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, magic is so... I mean, this opens up a whole new can of worms and I got to get ready for a show, but in a simple aspect of it is magic is so similar to stand-up comedy and other forms of performing, but and yet it's so different in that aspect of, yeah, he's doing that same trick that everybody does, but... He's doing it his own way to pay the bills so he can build something, you know, of his own creation and own artistic endeavor.
Yeah.
It's just it's a rotation. You got to do one to it's a yin yang. You got to do one to do the other, and that's just how it works in this art form, I guess. Yeah.
Well, that's one of the things again I'm enjoying about the ship shows is it's forcing me to be commercial, which is something that's actually really healthy for me, I think. But I can also do stuff I find creatively fulfilling. The audiences are receptive enough to the kinds of things I want to try. Not everything. I can't do things involving swearing or adult themes or anything that's really too high concept, but that's all right. There's places like Booby Trap I can do stuff like that. It's great. It's really good to have this ecosystem of different options, things going on.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good to play in different spaces.
And yet another reason why it's great to be back in LA. So...
Once again, back to the real estate thing, it's like, oh, it's so expensive to live here, but... With that,
so worth it.
It's worth it because you have so many other opportunities. Just whether or not they're paid opportunities, it's like tonight. Oh, can you pop in at Comedy Magic Club? Sure,
fantastic. Yeah,
great. I'll do. If I was living anywhere other than LA, I couldn't do that. So, this is how it is. Okay. Well, thanks for listening. Comments, questions, fan mail.
Macau Sessions, the epilogue. The final one.
Who knows? Maybe, you know what? We'll leave it open.
There might be Macau Sessions Part 2.
Maybe we'll just pop in once a month and just be like, so, how are you feeling about Macau now?
Let us know in the comments if that would interest you.
If you want to hear more non-specific Macau things, email us or send us on the Facebooks at Nick Paul Magic. And Instagram and your...
Things by Simon. On whatever app you currently have open, type Things by Simon into it and you will find me.
Mm-hmm. Or fan mail, hate mail to twomagicianswhenmike@gmail.com. That's it. Have a great day. Bye.